So with this, you know, this was just the first homework to give you a taste of what some of the assignments are going to be like. There's only three of them. And I recommend, you know, take advantage of the groups because this is not a long summer. And so there's not a lot of time to do a lot of this. If it, you know, typically I'd say 7 or better is pretty decent on the homework. So, you know, just something to look out for. And like I said, the first problem seemed to be the one that the most people had the issue with. After that, the other ones weren't too bad, and it kind of different people had different issues with different things. Sort of like, let's see. So problem one was tough. Problem two, the different points of view, problem two was the one with the, was problem two the one with the different points of view?
Yeah. Your discussion had helped us all when we talked.
Yeah.
So that was helpful.
Yeah. And there's different ways. And then when you get to the manifold stuff, people did pretty well with that. Because the basic idea of the manifold stuff is you can, you know, you have a cylinder, you can uncurl it. You have a, you know, you have this torus, and you can see how you can kind of uncurl it. Some people went more mathematical than others on it. And the whole thing about, you know, mapping two dimensions to one dimension, that was just something to kind of think about. But a lot of this course is just kind of stretching your mind around things that you wouldn't normally be able to observe. And so that's why I said, you know, whenever... there's really no way to check yourself completely on a lot of this stuff, but the best way I can think of is either if it's a flat space relativity problem, take the velocity down to zero, see if you get a reasonable answer. If it's a curved space, uncurl the space, see if it comes out as a reasonable answer. If it's you know, if it's something that you're doing with tensors, you can see if maybe there's a linear algebra way to do it. And then, you know, consistently see if you can look at things from more than one point of view, because that's the whole idea of relativity, is you have to be able to look at things from multiple points of view, and if you can do that, then you can, you know, get everything to work out. So today, we're going to start on Chapter 3, which is on curvature. And the first page out of this lecture is really going over some definitions. And then after we do that, the other stuff is essentially going into the real meat of this topic. So in the first part, I'm going to go over some stuff, and you're probably going to be sitting there thinking, okay, well, what the heck is that? And then the truth is I'll explain all this later. So everything I'm going over in the first page goes into more depth later on. Okay? So the first thing you'll hear is the term connection. And the connection refers to basically how do you connect vectors in the tangent space to nearby points. And that's what the globe is going to be used for a little bit later. Also, we have this thing called the Christoffel symbol, which I mentioned before, and that you may remember from math methods. And it's written as this capital gamma with a couple, with three indices on it. And it's defined in terms of the metric tensor. So I'm going to get into why it looks like this later on. And we can go into Sean.
Yeah.
And I'll go into more detail about how this is derived. One thing, though, is that to keep life simple, this comma is going to represent the partial derivative. So anytime you see anything like a tensor and it has a comma in it, comma means partial derivative. And that's because otherwise everything would get really ugly really fast. We're also going to be talking mostly about these things called covariant derivatives. And you notice instead of using the del operator, lowercase del, I'm using this uppercase del for this. So you can tell it's different than a partial derivative. It's a covariant derivative. And the covariant derivative is going to be defined to be the partial derivative and a linear transformation on whatever the vector is that you're taking the partial derivative of, or the covariant derivative of. And this is going to be represented by a semicolon.
What?
A semicolon.
It's
like a J. It's a semicolon. Yeah, I know, but it's like you have to kind of read this stuff in context.
In context.
Yeah, so it's like a J wouldn't make sense here because there's no J indice anywhere else.
And that's a Christoffel's symbol.
Yeah.
And it's for a linear.
It's like a linear transformation that is part. It is also called a connection. So the Christoffel symbol is a connection, but it's a connection that refers to space-time. If you get into some more abstract physics, you could say that like the vector potential in electromagnetism is actually a connection in a different way. But here, the Christoffel symbol is a connection, and it connects vectors in the tangent space to nearby points. Basically, the idea is that if you're on this globe and you want to take a derivative in this direction, you can't. If you're at the North Pole, the vector's pointing out this way. But you want to take a derivative and move down to this point. You can't just move straight out this way. You have to move out this way and then adjust and go down and stay on the globe, right? And the connection is what does that. So it keeps you on the curve space-time as opposed to just, flat space you fly off. In flat space, like on this table, you don't need a connection because everywhere is flat. You're always on the table.
So a connection is embedded in the equations when you're dealing with curve space.
Right. Yeah. It is, that's a good way to put it. It's embedded in the equations, and it's embedded in how you deal with these tensors and mathematics of the curved space. And, like I said, semicolon, covariant derivative, comma, regular derivative. I didn't invent that. It's just, that's just what other people have done. It's a convention.
Is there a contravariant derivative?
No.
Comma's partial derivative, semicolon is?
Covariant derivative.
Which is the second triangle.
Right. And the idea is that, a partial derivative does not transform like a tensor or a vector in curved space. But a covariant derivative is designed so that it does.
Mm-hmm. It's already embedded inside.
Yeah. It's embedded so it transforms like a tensor. And so if you, for example, if you've got in flat space, I have an example. I have the stress energy tensor, right? And if I take the partial derivative of that, where I'm contracting these two indices so that I am... just taking a divergence, then this is zero. However, if I do a coordinate transformation in curved space, this is not going to be zero. Therefore, I have my covariant derivative, which is going to be zero. So the laws of physics are going to be preserved for this in any kind of geometry of space, but for this partial derivative, it's not really going to work right. Yeah?
The covariant derivative, if you do that in flat space, does it work out to the same thing as the divergence?
Yeah, that's a good question, yes. It actually, what happens is in flat space, you'll see that this Christoffel symbol will disappear. And when the Christoffel symbol disappears, you're just going to end up with a covariant derivative equals partial derivative in flat space. And you'll notice it disappears because in flat space, the metric is a constant. And when you take partial derivatives of the metric in flat space, these all disappear. And therefore, the Christoffel symbol disappears. It's really neat. It's like it's there when you need it. It's not there when you don't.
So that actually what's in the parentheses is the trick of the connection.
Right. Which we'll derive this later as far as why it's equal to this. Actually, it's not as bad as you think. Now, also, we have this thing called the geodesics, and this comes from the geodesic equation, which is written here. And the idea is that any time you have an object, it will follow this geodesic path through space-time. And so if you have flat space, the covariant derivative this connection disappears, and you just have the acceleration equals zero. In other words, an object does not accelerate in the absence of a force. But in curved space-time, it does accelerate. And so this is also Einstein's equation that it explains how an object moves through curved space-time. How space-time causes gravity, effectively. And then there is the Riemann tensor, which this is the real definition of curvature. If this thing goes to zero, there's no curvature. If this thing is non-zero, then there's curvature. And so this is the only real true measure of curvature, and you get it from the Christoffel symbols which and their derivatives, which means that you get it from the metric. So it's almost like you have your metric, and you have to feed it through a process in order to see that you have your curvature. Okay. All right, so this is just a quick overview of the stuff we're going to be covering. And then if that were it for today, then you'd be shaking your heads and wanting your money back. So. All right, so as far as covariant derivatives go, the idea here is that whenever you do a coordinate transformation, we can't determine the curvature simply by looking at the metric. Because you can always, you know, like I showed you last time, do a transformation on the metric to make it look locally flat, in which case the first derivative vanishes, but then the second derivative is not vanishing. And it looks like flat space, but it's not really flat space. And you can do it the other way. You can take flat space and you can do coordinate transformations on it and make it look like it's some dynamic space when it's really not. An example of that, which we used as a test case in numerical relativity, we would call it the gauge wave, and it was basically a longitudinal wave in space, which physically, there's no such thing. But, you know, if you're, and since it's just flat space in an interesting, an interesting set of coordinates, then it should just evolve like no problem. So here, we need something more than just the metric, and we need something more than to see that things are curved and that things are going to work right. Also, another thing is that the partial derivative is not a good tensor operator. We need the connection to build this covariant derivative, which is a tensor operator. It transforms like a tensor, but reduces to a partial derivative when the curvature is gone. And so you need something like that so that when you're trying to find your divergence of your stress tensor, it's always going to be zero and the laws of physics are the same no matter what your geometry is. So the covariant derivative has to be coordinate independent form of the partial derivative. And so it needs to have the properties, it needs to be linear like a partial derivative, where if you take it and apply it to two different scalars or vectors or whatever, you can just sum them up. And it needs to also obey the chain rule, like a partial derivative, where if you have a tensor product, you can just simply use the chain rule and apply it to each term individually. And so basically, in order for it to work like this, it should basically be a partial derivative with some kind of linear transformation, and the linear part disappears when you go to flat space. And so you write it like this. And so we write it in saying that the covariant derivative of this vector v is just equal to a partial derivative of v plus this Christoffel connection contracted with v. And we just done the connection here so that when you contract over this indice, you have the same indices everywhere.
So similar to his question, if flat space, the Christoffel part would go to zero, And then the partial would just be equal to a del?
Mm-hmm. And that's why it is that, like, in flat space, you can just use the partials. You don't have to worry about covariant derivatives. But this also explains why it is that, like, if you're trying to take a divergence and you do it in Cartesian coordinates, it's really simple. But then try to do it in spherical coordinates, and you have to have all those extra terms in there. And those extra terms come from the fact that you have a curved space. And you can write it with this connection. And there's another way to write it, too, which we'll get to later. So the transformation of this would basically, you know, since this is a scalar, you can basically say we're transforming, it's a tensor, since these are two different ones. Then you could just say we're transforming to the primed coordinates. And then here, that means the transformation operator acting on this whole thing, if it transforms like a tensor. Which also should be the same thing as the transformation of the indices on each one of these. Okay? Because we're just going from unprime to prime. And that is the equivalent of taking the transformation matrices here and applying them to this whole statement. So you've got the derivatives for the transformation acting on the partial of this whole thing. And then you've got another transformation term where the transformation for is just acting on V, and the partial is acting on the other vector transformation. And then you have a third term which comes about because the transformation tensors are acting on this Christoffel symbol with the vector.
What's the difference between the first term and the second term?
Well, in the first term, you've basically got the transformation matrices acting on the partial first acting on the vector, kind of like this. The second term, you've got this transformation acting on the vector, and then you have a partial derivative acting on the other transformation.
Why do you have that?
It is because...
I should got it on the down triangles. It's like, to me, that's what it is. It's you're doing it on the two. You did it first on the upside down triangle, and then you did it on the vector.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, because you have to do it on the vector, and you have to do it on the partial. It's two separate things.
But unfortunately, one of the terms, you don't ever see the upside down V anymore. So I don't know, the upside down triangle.
Yeah.
Which one is the derivative of the upside down triangle? The first term or the second term?
Oh, this? Yeah. Are you talking about here?
Yeah.
This is the covariant derivative of V. So basically, it means you're taking a transformation of the entire covariant derivative as if it's one unit.
And then you take it of V alone?
Yeah, well, what's happening here is that...
I would think that would be included in the first term.
Actually, I think what's happening is this is a transformation basically acting on
the partial
derivative, and then this way it acts on V.
Oh, V alone.
Yeah. And then, because it basically, if you write it like this, it's like these two go together, and this transforms that, and then... And then
you pull the V out.
Yeah, and then you pull the V out, and then you get the other one.
And you get the other one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like you're using the product rule, but I don't see what the two different things are.
Well, the trick is that I'm going
to find. Let's see. Yeah, it's basically a product rule because it's actually on page 95 where I got this. So here, yeah, you got to transform V.
And we think that's the first term.
Right. Well, and also this term right here is also transforming V.
Well, except that one kind of carried down from the
yeah
from the first equation.
Mm-hmm.
we already knew it was going to have a V term and a Christoffel term, and the Christoffel term just Bert term.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, we kept these primed here because it's already, but we had to transform the other one from unprime to prime. So I think the idea here is you've got, and I tried to label these, like you got the first term, which is essentially the two transformations acting on this whole thing. And then you have the derivative of the transformation that has to occur because of, well, it's because of the chain rule, but also it's because the partial derivatives are supposed to commute. And I think that the idea here is that if you transform, you have to transform both the mu and the nu. So I'm thinking that this term comes about because of the chain rule with these. And then the last term is just transforming. You know, since you're transforming the vector first, and then you're taking the derivative of it. And I think that's where this comes from. And then the last term just comes from transforming that vector. Then, if you take this further, okay, you can see here that you get this expression here, where if you transform it another way, you've got the transformation of this entire thing, you know, the mu and nu together, and you've got a transformation of this entire other thing with the Christoffel. So what happened is, basically here, you can think of this as, if you got this transformation, and you claim that the covariant derivative transforms like a tensor, or like a vector, then you should be able to transform the vector and then do the covariant derivative. Or you can do the covariant derivative and then transform the vector. In either order doesn't matter. And so this is the natural result of first transforming the vector and then doing the covariant derivative. Does that make sense? And I labeled these 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 for each one of these components. Now, this stuff is crossed out. I don't know what the heck I was thinking there. So, never mind. Yeah. Yeah, forget about that. But you do notice that number 1 here is the same thing as number 4 here. And so that means that numbers 2 and 3, these two terms, should sum up the same as number 5 here, if all this is the same.
Then your next thing down there, 2, 3, and 5, should be the 2 from before, the 3 from before, and then the 5.
Right.
I thought you said the 5 equals 2 plus 3.
Yeah, 5 equals 2 plus 2. Yeah, 2 plus 3 equals 5. What does? So, anyway, so when you equate these together, what this allows you to do is to rewrite, you know, you can get rid of the vector, because it's just an arbitrary vector, and you can rewrite the Christoffel symbol, the transformation of the Christoffel symbol. And so you can rewrite the Christoffel symbol in terms of the primed Christoffel symbol.
Why would you want to?
Well, because what this proves to us is that the Christoffel symbol doesn't transform like a tensor. Because it's got this term, which looks like a tensor transformation acting on the Christoffel symbol. And then you got this other junk left over, which came from up here. And so the basic result of this is saying that, well, the Christoffel symbol doesn't transform like a tensor.
That's because the Christoffel symbol is for curve space?
No, it's just that's one of the properties of it. It's just not a tensor.
Okay.
And so it looks like a tensor, and you know it has all the indices like a tensor, but it's not really a tensor. So it doesn't transform like a tensor. If it did, then adding it to a partial derivative, which is not a tensor, would result in something that's not a tensor. So it kind of you kind of need something that's not a tensor to transform with something else that's not a tensor in order to form a tensor, if that makes any sense.
So what's the tensor that it's forming? Is that the covariant derivative?
Yeah, the covariant derivative is the tensor that it forms. Now, if you do a dual vector instead, a dual vector, we assume we got some other connection. It's like a covariant, like a Christoffel symbol here. And we're just summing up the indices a little bit different so everything works. And we also have, it has to have a couple other properties. One is that it needs to commute with contractors. So that if you have a tensor here and you are taking the covariant derivative of it, it should be the same thing as if you just take the covariant derivative and then you do all the contractions. And it should reduce to partial derivatives when you're dealing with a scalar. Since if you think about it, you know, it doesn't matter if you're in curved space or flat space.
Scalar's
invariant. And plus, you know, if you look at on a sphere, like the equations of, like the derivative on a sphere, a gradient on a sphere, as opposed to on a, as opposed to a divergence, and even in a sphere, it looks pretty simple. So,
on the edit page where you had that Christoffel symbol with the tilde on it, over it,
mm-hmm.
So that wasn't really a Christoffel symbol.
We don't know, but it looks like a Christoffel symbol.
But you said, but this one with the tilde transforms. No, it says it has the same ones as a Christoffel.
Same properties as a Christoffel symbol.
Well, which means that it does not transform like a tensor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not really at all. You know, you could say it flies like a chicken.
Which they don't fly too
much. Yeah, not too much. All right, so now if you want to figure out what this thing is, then what you have to do is if you take a scalar product between a vector and a dual vector, then the result should be something which is going to be just a partial derivative. So if we do that by chain rule, we should be able to get the partial derivative of this and then its Christoffel symbol equivalent, and then the same thing for the vector. And that all should reduce down to partial derivative of the scalar. So the partial derivative of a scalar by chain rule just looks like this, which means the Christoffel symbol terms here should just cancel out. That happens if this Christoffel symbol for the dual is just minus the Christoffel symbol for the regular one, for the vector. So if that's the case, then we can just say that we'll just throw a minus sign on the Christoffel symbol when we're talking about dual vectors. So we can do a covariant derivative on a dual vector by having minus signs. And you can see you're summing over these two indices. Where with a vector, you're basically summing over these indices. Okay? And so if you have what the covariant derivative of a tensor, then you basically go through with the partial derivative, and then you just throw in Christoffel symbols, and you sum over all the different indices. And so that way you can take a covariant derivative of anything. And you'll notice that these things are not going to be simple because you got three indices, and you've got into the third components, therefore, because you have all the different combinations of them, and so that means that in four dimensions you've got 64 different terms you can make out of that. Which means that if you're doing this by hand, this is going to be a lot of work. But that's one thing about relativity, is it tends to be very tedious because there's all these different elements to it, and you just have to, yeah, you either have to exploit symmetries or you have to just know how to calculate them all. Now, the connection transports a vector from one tangent space to another. So if you look at the difference between two connections, it should be like a tensor. And so in this case, I use this tensor, S, is just the difference in two Christoffel symbols. So, since all it's doing is just translating from one tangent space to another one, and if you have another connection, you're just translating to another one. And so if you look at the difference between two covariant derivatives, in this case I'm taking a covariant derivative in one geometry minus the covariant derivative of something in a different geometry, where the twiddle means it's a different geometry, then you could say that, you know, you expand it out, and you know the partial derivatives are the same, so they fall out. And so you could say that this is just some tensor acting on that vector. If the so we could say that the difference between any two Christoffel symbols is itself a tensor. Takes a little bit to really get that.
Now here you call both of those Christoffel symbols.
Yeah.
But before, two pages earlier, the tilde over it, it was, we didn't know it was a Christoffel symbol.
Well, it was a different kind of Christoffel symbol.
It's a negative.
Yeah. But what we're saying here is that the tilde here represents a different geometry. Mm-hmm. So one of these could be in cylindrical space, the other could be in spherical space, or something like that.
And the S is what?
It's just a tensor, which represents the difference between the two. So what this means is that you can kind of relate any two Christoffel symbols by a tensor.
That's funny, because they don't behave like a tensor, but
yeah,
you can relate them by a tensor.
Yeah.
Who figures this stuff out?
So they're not tensors, but they're also subtractive on the tensor.
Right.
Bizarre, huh?
Yeah, it's bizarre, and I think I don't know. I don't want to even go into a geometric proof of that, because I'm thinking that would be pretty involved. But how this is useful to us, and this is kind of what we skip down to, is if we look at the difference between these two Christoffel symbols, where all we've done is just flipped the order of the two lower elements, then we say that that's a tensor, and that's going to be called a torsion tensor. And you can write it like this, since this is the anti-symmetric symbol.
What is that?
Oh, which one?
What?
That's a 2.
It looks like a 2. It is a 2.
Yeah. It looks like a 2, it is a 2. And so this brings up two more properties that allow us to isolate the connection and the metric relationship.
Look at that little box around lower, the subscripts mean.
Oh, these?
Anti-commutative.
This means anti-commutative, which means they're anti-symmetric.
Okay.
With respect to these two indices. And then these parentheses means that they are symmetric.
Okay.
And so what this is saying here, property number 5 is saying, is that you want to only use Christoffel symbols that are symmetric. And so the torsion tensor drops to 0, and it's called torsion free. The reason why we do that is because...
Is that the torsion tensor up there? Is that in the ballpark of angular change, angular torsion, torque?
Not really.
Really?
Yeah, not really.
Okay.
So here, if you look at this, see, you may want to go back a little bit further. When you look at this definition of the covariant vector that we've got here, and you notice that we're summing over these two indices, what would happen if we just switched the order of these? I mean, that could cause a problem. And so I guess the idea is that by making it torsion free, you could either sum over the first indice or the second indice. It doesn't matter. But with the with the covariant vector, you notice you're summing over the top and the bottom. There's only one up there. So it's not much of a problem. But there's another reason why this needs to be torsion free, and that is because if we want to define a Christoffel symbol which depends only on a particular choice of metric, then it has to be torsion free. And we'll go in, we'll be able to see that a little bit better as we move on. Another thing is that we want the covariant derivative of the metric to always be equal to zero, so that the metric never is kind of constant with respect to the curvature, which makes sense because on this sphere, the covariant derivative of that metric, the metric shouldn't change as you go around it, effectively, if it's the same manifold. And so if you didn't have this property, then you don't really get a unique connection that works. And then also the Levi-Civita, it has a covariant derivative of zero, but you know it's all made up of ones, so that's not a big surprise. And the inverse metric has a covariant derivative of zero. And so these are just extra properties that they've thrown on to this connection or covariant this Christoffel symbol in order to make all this stuff work. Now, by having this property that the metric, the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, what this allows you to do is that if you put the metric in front of this covariant derivative, you can actually bring it inside with the vector, and it can raise the or lower the indice of the vector. So the metric can just move in and out of these covariant derivatives, and it's no problem.
Because you're basically using the product rule where one of the terms is a zero.
Right, right. And so if the metric commutes with the covariant derivatives, then there's not a problem. If it doesn't, then there becomes all kind of issues. And you couldn't move a metric in and out. It would the math would get a lot worse. It's
and
bad enough already. What?
When would it not commute the metric and the derivatives?
Oh, if it's a partial derivative.
And you're in class
this
state,
is a
aren't you?
Partial derivative.
No, this is a covariant derivative.
Okay.
It does. It, the metric commutes with the covariant derivative.
Okay.
If it were a partial derivative, then it doesn't necessarily commute. And it's kind of, like I said, the whole idea of that is to be able to raise or lower the indice inside without doing any, you know, without messing up the equation. And so the idea then is if you put all these extra conditions in, then there's only one torsion-free metric compatible connection per manifold. And so every manifold is only going to have one connection that you have to have that's going to describe it. Also, another reason why we get this torsion-free deal comes from the fact that the metric is symmetric by itself. And so the symmetric metric leads to a symmetric connection. And so we'll show you that here, where this is actually how you derive the definition of that Christoffel symbol. And what happens is here are the three, you're taking covariant derivatives of the metric, but you're permutating these three indices in every possible way. So what happens is the first one, you got a partial respect to rho on the metric, and then you've got you're minus the Christoffel symbol with one of the indices, and then you've got minus the Christoffel symbol with the other indice, and it's equal to zero. And then you do the same thing, but you flip some of the indices around. You know, rho goes to the back, and then everything else moves forward. Do the same thing, and then you do the same thing again with nu. And you'll notice here, when you look at these, that this term and this term are exactly alike, and this term and that term are exactly alike, and this term and that term are exactly alike.
Christoffel symbols?
No, well, yeah, they are, because here these two indices are flipped, but the metric indices are also flipped.
Okay.
So you'll notice the metric is symmetric, so these two are the same. And if you make the Christoffel symbol also symmetric, then these two are equivalent. If they're not symmetric, then these don't. This doesn't work. And that's another reason why we say these have to be symmetric.
Why is it a minus on the Christoffel symbol?
Because this is a covariant tensor. Remember, when you're taking a covariant derivative of a covariant tensor, those terms give you the minus on the Christoffel. If it was contravariant, then it would have a plus sign. So if you take all these are all adding up to zero, then you can basically you know, add them all up, and all of them are going to add up to zero, and so you get each, you know, you can have this one, this first one here, minus the second one, and minus the third one, and as a result, if you add them up right, then it's going to cancel out all but two of these Christoffel symbols.
And why don't you have four terms, since you have four subscripts that you would put them
in? You mean three subscripts.
That's because I don't
know what I mean. Rho, mu, and nu. Just three. So that's why we only have three. And so what happens is when you do that, you have this first two Christoffel symbols here, and you subtract out, you're basically going to end up getting rid of this one and getting rid of this one. And then these two are the only ones left, but they're the same, and they're being subtracted, so it ends up giving you plus two in the Christoffel symbol in the metric. Well, you just do a little bit of algebra from here. Move this over to the other side. Divide through by 2, and then multiply by the inverse metric. And what you end up with is the Christoffel symbol defined in terms of the metric. And you could see here that if you change mu and nu, then effectively these two terms are the same. So nothing changes in this one, it just flips these two around. So it is symmetric with respect to those two indices. And so by applying all these conditions, this is the only Christoffel symbol that works. It's torsion, it has to be torsion-free, and it has to have the covariant derivative of the metric equal to zero. And it also has to be linear operator and all that other stuff.
Now, I noticed that when you went from this line, going from...
That one?
No, down, that one to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
On the Christoffel symbol, you change the upper index from a lambda to sigma.
Yeah, I did that.
Is that just arbitrary?
Yeah.
Don't matter. You also change it on the matrix. I mean, the inverse metric.
Yeah, but you know, that the cool thing about it is, you can, if you're summing over an index, you can do whatever you want. So, I mean, since you're summing over them anyway. Well, the reason why I did that...
I would have spent hours.
Okay, here's why I did that. One of the rules to doing tensor math is you do not have triple indices. So, for example, if I have this... can't remember what that other one was. Below. Okay, if I have this... And I want to get rid of this metric term. I need to multiply by its inverse. If I put in this, what happens? It's ugly. Because am I summing over these two indices or am I summing over these two indices? It's confusing. So what you do is you make sure you don't have any triple summations or triple indices like that where it might be summed. And so we put in something like this with the inverse. And then that mathematically is equal to this, which is equal to this. Okay? So the idea is you want to avoid those summations where they become like really arbitrary and you don't know whether you're summing over these two indices or these two indices. You can see the row, there was only one of those, so that wasn't an issue. And meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, I only had to put in the inverse metric with the rho sigma, or sigma rho.
Back to your page again.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of one of those things that it's just good practice when you're doing this type of math. Is anything you do with mathematics, you want to make sure that it's something where if you come back and you look at it a year later, you know what the heck you did. Okay, everybody got that? All right, so by doing that, we end up with the definition of the Christoffel symbol. Now, you do a couple examples of how and where you would use these. The first one is you've got flat space polar coordinates. So it's just two dimensions, just to make it easy. And you've got the ds squared is defined like so. And so you could say that grr is just 1, and g theta theta is just 1 over r squared. And this is the inverse metric as opposed to the metric. And so when you use this equation here, you can calculate all the Christoffel symbols from it. And so when you calculate the Christoffel symbols, you can have the one that has all r's, in which case you're summing like so. And you could see that you can have the sigma term can either be r or theta in this case. If it's r, then you get this. If it's theta, you get this. And so you're summing up all those different alternatives. And what happens is that the derivative, partial derivative with respect to r of grr is 0. And same thing for this one, same for this one. So that's nothing interesting. For the theta terms, there is no...
Are those all r's?
Yeah, for the top one, because, you know, we're just summing over. We already said that the two bottom terms are r.
Okay.
And the top term has to be r.
All right.
So that's just the rule of the game. So we didn't have any real room to make anything else anything but r. And so for when we put rho equal to r, it came out to be 0. If you put rho equal to theta, then there's no cross term here for r theta. So this is 0 and that's 0. And then here you've got a theta derivative of grr, which is 0. So the result is 0. And then you got to do the same thing for r theta theta. And so you put, basically it means that these bottom indices are thetas, which means everywhere you see a mu or nu is theta. And then, so you get this. And then you can just fill in, well, what does the, what's this other term going to be for rho? And if you set it equal to theta, it's 0 because the inverse metric r theta is 0. If you set it equal to r, then you got a chance. And so you set that equal to r. This term is 0 because there's no cross term. This is 0 because there's no cross term. This term, however, is 1 over r squared. R squared. You're taking the r derivative of that, which gives you r. So minus r. And then you go through all the different...
Is r squared and not 1 over r squared?
Well, yeah, because this is the metric here. This is the metric here. That's the inverse metric.
Okay. Inverse metric.
Yeah. And so you go through all the other combinations. What you'll find is that for the r theta r term and the r r theta term, which are, of course, symmetric because, you know, no torsion, it's 0. For the theta RR term, it's going to come out to be 0. For the theta theta R, you're going to get 1 over R. And for the theta theta theta, you get 0. And so basically, you just have to run through and calculate all these different possibilities for each of the different dimensions and everything.
And for your summary there, why didn't you list the Christoffel with the superscript R in a sub... They pulled a minus star. It's not in your summary because...
Which one?
What is the bottom of the previous page?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not a summary. That's all the others.
Oh, that's the other one.
That's the other ones that we haven't done. So, yeah, you got these two that I worked out completely. And then these are just sort of saving you some time. So if you add them all up, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different Christoffel terms.
Which we expect to go to 2 to the 3rd.
Yeah, which is 2 to the 3rd, which is what you expect. So for just two dimensions, you end up with 8 Christoffels you have to solve for in each. Well, and but there's some symmetry, of course, between these, and because of the symmetry, that saves you some trouble, and so that knocks it down from 8 to 6. And so if you have to do this in a four-dimensional space, it's going to get a lot hairier. Because you got 64, but then you got, you know, you remove the duplicates from when they're each one. So you end up with, let's see, 64 minus or two at a time. I think it still ends up being like 50-something. Can't think of it off the top of my head. Now, from this, you can get the formulas for divergence, the gradient, and the curl, and the curve coordinates. So for that curve space-time, you can calculate gradients or whatever, which is exactly like the inside cover of your Jackson or whatever textbook. And also, we can make the metric appear flat at a point and therefore make the Christoffel symbols vanish at that particular point. And that kind of goes back to the last lecture where when we made that transformation to make the Christoffel symbol appear flat, its first derivative also disappeared, which basically got rid of the Christoffel symbol. Now, another thing to note is the divergence is basically now this covariant derivative where you have the same indice as the vector. But you can also write this covariant this Christoffel symbol in terms of the determinant of the metric. And this is one of your problems on your homework.
About that
question. Mm-hmm.
And you have number 2.
It was previously homework number 3. Now it's homework number 2.
Oh, not problem number 2, just homework set.
Yeah, homework set number 2. I think it's problem 3-2. Yeah.
Well, problem number 2 in chapter 3.
Yeah, problem number 2 in chapter 3. No, problem number 3 in chapter 3 is where you actually prove this. Yeah.
So the G without the indices on it?
Is a determinant.
Okay. So that's the determinant of...
the metric.
And that's just the...
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So basically what happens is if you take your metric, you can write it as if it's a matrix. Like if I'm doing curve coordinates like this, and this is for spherical coordinates, then I can write the determinant of that. And if I take the square root of that determinant, then I get r squared sine theta, which is what you'd integrate when you're trying to integrate over a sphere. So this just shows you that the if you can... you can actually do this in order to make up for some of the Christoffel symbols and just write them in terms of the determinant of the metric, since they are tied to the metric. In which case, then, you can, since you know what the derivative of the determinant of the metric is, and this is a partial derivative of the vector, and so by chain rule, you can kind of put these two together. And you can see here that when you take a derivative with respect to vector, partial derivative with respect to vector, you just have this over itself, which cancels out and gives you this term. And then you take the derivative of this, then the vector just kind of flows right through, and you end up with this Christoffel symbol term. So it's kind of a neat mathematical thing in that you can, whenever you're doing derivatives in these curved coordinates, like a spherical or cylindrical space, you're really using these connections. You just don't see it. You also get these things like Stokes' theorem in a curved space-time, where in Stokes' theorem, you know, you have a divergence over a volume. And you could turn it into an integral, a surface integral, over the boundary for that volume. And what's happening here is we just have an arbitrary dimensional space, and we're integrating over this entire surface, this entire manifold, and we have the determinant with this thing in order to give us the whole volume integral. And then what happens is it becomes an integral over a hypersurface, where this partial sigma is a hypersurface. N here is the normal to the hypersurface. And then you've got whatever the vector is, and you've got this thing, which is actually the determinant of the metric of the hypersurface, which is basically means the metric minus that one dimension. And now you're just integrating over all but that one dimension. And so it's basically the same thing as like a divergence rule, a divergence theorem or Stokes theorem or whatever you want to call it.
So what's the difference between the gamma metric and the G metric?
This has one less dimension than that one does. So for example, I guess the best example of this comes from numerical relativity, where if we want to describe the space-time of a black hole, okay, then it basically looks like this, and it's like, say there's two of them, and in time, it's going to keep changing. So what we do is we literally take the space-time and we slice it up so that this represents the metric at a time t naught, and this represents the metric at a time t naught plus delta t. Okay? Then what happens is you can almost look at space-time as if you've got all of these different frames from a camera, or you know, like a movie, and you've got what happened at time t0, what happened at time t0 plus delta t, what happened at the next time, and you can just kind of break it up, in which case each one of these represents sigma, or hypersurface, at that particular time. And if you put them all together, then you get the full metric. So we can take space-time and just divide it up however we want. The one thing that's interesting with this is that, you know, how time moves is depends on the observer. So we can actually have to define an observer and say that the observer is seeing the time sliced in a certain way. And we can slice up space and time and show it like this. And then this is useful then because then we can, instead of having to integrate over space and time, we can just focus on space here and know all the physics. Okay. All right. Any questions on that stuff so far? Okay. This is where we got our globe here for today. This is called parallel transport, and also I'm going to talk about geodesics. Now, the idea here is that covariant derivatives are designed to measure the rate of change of tensor fields in comparison to what would be they would be if they were parallel transported. And so the idea of parallel transport is if you move a vector or a tensor along a path, keeping it constant, then this is, you know, which is trivial in flat space, the covariant derivative of the metric should always be zero. So in other words, and there's a good picture here, it's also in the book, where you have this curved space path. And so you can imagine I have my pencil here representing a vector, and I'm starting off at the North Pole. Then I take this vector, and I move it forward here, and then I roll around the equator for a little bit. Then I come back up. Now all of a sudden the vector's pointing in a different direction. So it doesn't do well for physics if you don't know what your vector is going to do. And so that's what they call parallel transport, because you're just basically transporting a vector along this curved space, and when you move it along curved space, it changes. So you could start off with a vector that's pointing in this direction and end up with one pointing in the other direction.
It's interesting that these mathematicians chose to do it that way instead of moving
the Yeah, you could have. But then again, you have to assume then that the U.S. is interchangeable with China or something like that. So you run into problems if... But, you know, so you have to be able to constantly know what's going on with that, and that's one of the reasons why the covariant vector comes in, is to try to figure out what's going on. So if you keep a vector constant, it implies then that if when you take this derivative, you get zero for your tensor. And so that means that you have this partial derivative here, and then this is a derivative with respect of the coordinate with respect to whatever that parameter is, and you're commuting the two. And so we define this thing called a directional covariant derivative, where a directional covariant derivative basically means that you have this derivative with respect to the coordinate and the covariant derivative with respect to that coordinate. And so it ends up working out that this lambda, which could be something like time or whatever parameter it is, ends up being what you're really taking the derivative respect to, but then this kind of brings in the covariant derivative part. And so when you do that, you get that your tensor, the directional covariant derivative of your tensor, is going to look like a covariant derivative of this, and then the derivative of the coordinate respect to that parameter. And this is called your parallel transport equation. And so for vectors, it's like when you take this covariant derivative, you get the expansion of this thing, where you have now, it's like a derivative respect to lambda, and then you have here this extra term, which comes in from this guy, and then your Christoffel symbol, etc. And it's basically saying that when you do this properly, you end up getting no change in your you basically get no change in your vector when you move it along this path, because the vector is constant. So for a metric compatible connection, the metric is always going to be parallel transported with respect to the connection. So because you have this covariant derivative of the metric equals zero, then that process is going to be always zero, so it means that your metric is going to be constant everywhere. And if you take this, where it's a dot product of the metric with two vectors, it's just you use the chain rule, and then you know that this term is going to fall to zero, and you end up with just these other two parts, where each one of these is going to give you zero if these are also constant vectors. So the norm of the vectors and the orthogonality is going to be preserved. And that's the whole idea, is that you don't want your vectors to change length, which is really what the norm is, and you don't want them to cease to be orthogonal if they were orthogonal before.
Oh, you mean if you were moving two vectors? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're moving two vectors and they were orthogonal before, you still want them to be orthogonal. All right. So the reason why we're going into this is because this brings up the idea of the geodesic. And the geodesic curve is basically a generalization of a straight line in Euclidean space, which means that everything that works, you know, shortest distance between two points is a straight line. That geodesic is going to be that line. And so the path that parallel transport its own tangent vector is going to be the geodesic. Yeah?
Is that what airplanes follow when they're going from Chicago to Moscow?
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they can't... I mean, if you really look at the globe, like, pretend this is Earth. You can't go through the center of the Earth.
Oh, I know.
So you have to go around.
But they don't go around. They go over. They go way up north and then down.
Mm-hmm. So they're following some kind of curvature of the Earth. in order to do it.
And it's the shortest curve along the surface.
Yeah. I mean, it never really looks right on a flat map because the, you know, flat map's not accurate. Yeah.
I'd be looking on the globe. If you measure on the globe.
Okay. All right. So by definition, a geodesic is going to be a path that parallel transports its own tangent vector. And so what that means is that if we take x mu to be the path, and the tangent vector is going to be the derivative of the coordinate with respect to lambda. So then the parallel transport, if this is a constant vector, is going to be that this is equal to zero. So therefore, when you apply this to what we have for the coordinate, then you end up basically you're taking this derivative where you're having this partial coordinate with respect to lambda and then a covariant derivative, and you're having that act on this tangent vector. And so that's the same thing from here. When you take that first partial, you end up getting the second derivative term here. And then the rest of it comes about because of taking the Christoffel symbol, and then you end up with the other coordinate derivative, and then the final one. And so this is the geodesic equation, and it literally just comes from just taking this and applying it to that vector, the tangent vector. And also this tangent vector is really the same thing as four velocity, if you think about it, because this is basically how does a path change or curve change or coordinate change with respect to time or whatever parameter. And so, and this is the literal geodesic equation Einstein would use. Yeah?
On a globe, where is that lambda? What is the physicality of that lambda?
Oh, that's a... The physical lambda is actually almost exactly like this, but with a phi term as well. So if you start off with this metric, which, you know, you add a r squared sine theta d phi squared term, then that will give you the Christoffel symbols that relate to that globe exactly. So all you have to do is just go from here to there. But the only thing is a little bit more complicated because you're going to have a couple more terms.
But that's the connection, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And so once you have that for a globe, then that's going to give you the geodesic equation for a globe. And then you notice here that, again, if the Christoffel symbol goes to zero, like in flat space, then this is just acceleration equals zero. And let me show you how you use this thing. Well, if you've got proper time is for a path is defined by this equation. This is just what we did before. And you know that this is the same thing as the square root of, I say, minus some function d lambda, where this function is all this stuff in the parentheses. Pretty much. So if we want to minimize the path, minimize the proper time, then that's just going to be equal to the integral of the delta of this thing. It's kind of like principle of least action. And the delta of this ends up being minus 1/2. And you have this to the minus 1/2, and you have a delta f, because it's like you're taking a derivative. So then what we're going to do is that we know that if we take lambda and we make it into proper time, tau, then this partial of, or this derivative of the coordinate with respect to lambda, this tangent vector, is just going to become proper time.
Is that the 4 velocity?
Or 4 velocity, thank you. And so then if that's 4 velocity, then your function f just becomes the metric, becomes this 4 velocity, And if you dot these two together, you get minus 1. So then F is equal to minus 1, which means that this term is just going to become 1. And you just have the minus 1 half delta F. If you take delta tau to 0, which basically means that you, you know, you want the minimum time between points. And then you can solve this thing further, because now you're basically solving 0 is equal to this integral, which minimizes the path. And so we do, you want to solve this this integral. You have this, you have to define it here, where we have the integral I is equal to 1 half f d tau, which is equal to all of this. If you take your path and you perturb it slightly by putting in a delta x, and you take your metric and you turn it into the metric with some Taylor expansion, so you're perturbing it slightly along the path, then you can take your delta I, which is your delta of this, which is your this equation, and it's just going to be equal to taking your metric term that was here, expanding it out with its Taylor expansion, and then, let's see, once we've expanded that out with its Taylor expansion, you can go through and integrate each part. And so the first part you have here is you've got a term here where you have the metric and you have a delta on the x, and then this part right here, and that's going to be this integral. And then you're going to go through and get this term and integrate that, and then you're going to go on to the other higher order terms. And so when you integrate this, we use integration by parts in order to you know, make this a little bit easier to deal with. And that turns this into a second derivative. And then also it turns the metric into a derivative with respect to tau. And then you have the delta x, which is pulled out. And so you've got this. And now when you take this derivative of the metric with respect to tau, they're able to turn this into a partial derivative of the metric with respect to the coordinate, and then a derivative of the coordinate with respect to tau. Can't see how that kind of works? And then you can take this, and when you have this term here, this is starting to look like a Christoffel symbol because it's got the first piece of it. And so what they did was they just said, well, we've got this is equal to minus this first term, and then you got the 1 half, and then these other two terms are kind of brought in to complete the Christoffel symbol. And they did it in such a way that basically it, you know, you just added in perturbations of it in order to make this work. And so when we complete the Christoffel symbol here, then this basically, you could see all this stuff in the parentheses is just being multiplied by the delta x squared. Or, sorry, the delta x. And so when you set this equal to 0, it implies that all the stuff in the parentheses must be equal to 0. And so you have this term here. You have all this other stuff, which looks like the beginning of the Christoffel symbol. You've got these four velocity terms here. And so then all they did was just multiply this by its inverse metric. And then now you have the acceleration term. And then this completes the Christoffel symbol for this and the four velocity. And so you end up with the geodesic equation after all that. So the whole idea here is that if you're going to follow this path the shortest path between points in space-time, you're going to follow the geodesic. And that this curvature of space-time is going to alter what path you're going to follow. So if you're in flat space and nothing else is around, nothing interesting, this says you're not going to accelerate. And the closest way to get from here to your future is to stand still. But if you're in curved space, the shortest way path between you and your future is going to be through this curved space-time. And so that's why any object in the gravitational field is going to follow this geodesic. Okay. I know that's a handful there.
So I appear to be in flat space, but I'm really in curved space, and I'm really continually following my geodesic.
Mm-hmm.
As the Earth spins around and flies through space.
Yep.
And it's an illusion that I'm sitting still.
Right. And if the floor were to fall out from underneath you, you'd just keep falling out geodesic even further. Only thing the floor is doing is keeping you from falling your geodesic further down the path. Okay. All right. So this is basically two different ways of deriving this geodesic equation is from that. And that's basically what you get out of that. Now, what this says, and this just under different properties of it, if you have an unaccelerated test particle, it's always going to follow the geodesic. And so we write here F equals MA, effectively, which is basically saying the geodesic represents the acceleration part, and then this is electromagnetic force per unit mass. So this four velocity here represents the four velocity of a charged particle in an electromagnetic field. And so all you have to do is take your tau and turn it into lambda, and it becomes what they call an affine parameter, which is basically it's a linear transformation on tau. So it's time, but it's not time. It's not proper time exactly. But it varies kind of like proper time. And this is just kind of used for parameterizing the equation where you don't necessarily want to use proper time. Okay. So since the idea of this whole geodesic equation stuff is that the geodesic is a path that parallel transports its own tangent vector, then if you have a time-like path, you can say that the geodesic equation is written like this. Because it's literally, that's what this does, is it just parallel transports its own tangent vector. And if you take your four momentum to be equal to this, where it's equal to m times your four velocity, then you could say your four momentum follows this geodesic equation too. And a freely falling particle will keep moving in the direction of its momentum. And that's basically what the physics behind that says. And if it's not freely falling and it gets in a gravitational field, then it'll just keep falling the geodesic in. Now, if you take a null path, what happens is the proper time goes to zero, and that's one of the reasons why you want to use this affine parameter, because, zero doesn't work very well here. But for an affine parameter, you can have that be non-zero while the proper time goes to zero.
Which letter up there is the affine parameter?
Lambda. Yeah. Tau is proper time. So the four momenta for a null geodesic is going to go like this, where this is effectively four momenta, and this is your coordinate and your affine parameter. We're not even looking at mass because it's something moving at the speed of light, so mass is not going to show up. And so it looks a lot like four velocity. And the energy comes from contracting the four momenta with the four velocity. So that's the energy measured by the observer. And so you can actually handle a massless particle moving at the speed of light with the same stuff. And basically what this says is that even light or massless particle is still going to follow these geodesics, which kind of came down to how Einstein was able to predict the curvature of light, you know, coming from around the sun. And so that's all because of this. All right, now we'll talk about exponential maps and different types of maps here. And the idea here is that you want to be able to map tangent space to a region of a manifold containing some P using geodesics. P here is the point that you're interested in. So the tangent space at T sub P represents the tangent space at point P. And you want to map this to a region of the manifold which contains that point P using the geodesics. In other words, you want to be able to see where your thing is going to go, where your object is going to move. So you've got this, assume you have this unique geodesic path where you have a curve, tangent vector, parameterized by lambda. I'm going to take lambda equal to 0 and say that this is some vector k at this particular parameterization. Where here, k exists in this tangent space, and lambda as a function of p is equal to 0. And we're going to use this exponential map to map from this tangent space to a manifold m, where somewhere on the manifold, lambda is going to be equal to 1. So in other words, just mapping it from lambda equals 0 to lambda equals 1. And you can think of them as two different times or whatever. So we have an exponential map of k is equal to the coordinate at lambda equals 1. And so this should be some unique solution for the geodesic, which shows what some unique path that this thing is going to follow. And so that's called an exponential map because it's actually just, I'm not sure exactly why they use the word exponential, but the idea here is that you did map from, map somewhere along the geodesic.
Well, in the book in page equation 3.65, where they have EXP, now is that an exponential or there on your writing?
I think I call it exponential.
Is it related to the...
No.
Exponential?
No, it's not related to like E to the whatever, no.
It's a different exponential.
Yeah. It's a different exponential.
It's just short for exponential now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As far as I know, it was...
Running out of alpha letters.
Yeah, as far as I know, it was named after John D. Exponential. So, now if you look at figure 3.4, they show it here where you've got this tangent space and you're essentially mapping this vector along. And you have to follow this... You just have this one curve that'll get you from point A to point B. And so that's sort of like if... if I drop this globe, I say that, well, this globe, it's starting here. It has to go through this particular point in space-time. There's only one path that it's allowed to follow through that path, through that space-time, and get to the end point. If it follows any other path, it won't hit it. And so that's all this is really saying is that, you know, we're just basically mapping things to a manifold where we can see that unique solution. Okay. All right, now the next thing, we have this definition called a singularity. And a singularity is a place where geodesics appear to end because, you know, you just can't follow them any further than that. And the use of an exponential map can construct locally inertial coordinates. For example, here they're basically taking the metric and they're turning it into what looks like a flat space-time. If you have a point Q and it's close to some other point P, then there's a unique geodesic path that goes from P to Q or from Q to P, and a unique parameterization lambda such that if lambda of p is 0, lambda of q is 1. So it tells you not only do you have to go through this point, but you have to get there at a certain time. You know, it's kind of like if if something fell off a building, it has to pass by a certain point, and it has to pass by that certain point at a certain time. It can't stop and wait and then hit that point later. Yeah. So if you say that K is this K with this basis vector, and you say that this is the path at Q is K, then the components of K that get mapped to Q by the exponential map are going to go something like that. And this is called the Riemann normal coordinates at P. And so here's just to verify what happens. You can see here, if you start off with your path and it's parameterized by lambda, and you're following this geodesic, which is in a flat space geodesic, just to be simple. So this is, we know then that the geodesic equation, a full geodesic equation, looks like this. Where here, K rho is this 4 velocity. And so the only way that you can make these two look the same is if the right-hand side here goes to 0. And if this goes to 0, it means that the Christoffel symbol went to 0, which meant that basically your covariant derivative is the same thing as your partial derivative. And so just basically just saying that, you know, you just followed this straight line through flat space to go from point A to point B. And of course, you can get to a lot more interesting things than that. Okay. So you guys thoroughly confused enough. Okay. I'm going to stop here for today. This is enough stuff to kind of stop and let soak in. But the basic ideas here is, dealing with this Christoffel symbol and knowing the difference between covariant derivatives and other, and just partial derivatives. And a lot of what's coming up for the rest of the chapter is just looking at applications of this. And also, we're going to go into actually calculating the Riemann tensor and what that is, which is kind of like the step beyond the Christoffel symbol. Like you guys may remember from math methods, you still we did do a little bit with the Christoffel symbol in math methods. It just was just very, very little, and that's about as far as we went. But with this class, we're actually going to go all the way into the Riemann, which is what you need to calculate if you're going to calculate the left-hand side of Einstein's equations. And it's the real thing for telling whether or not you're in a curved space. Okay. So with this stuff, you can always, if you're just dealing with the Christoffel symbol, you're just dealing with the geodesic equation, you can always take your curved space and you can make it look like flat space and then solve the problem and have a simpler problem to solve. So, for example, if you take that full equation here, and let's say you had an object and it was passing through space-time and along this curved path and it was following this geodesic, you could actually do a coordinate transformation, make this look locally like flat space, kill the Christoffel symbol, in which case now you can solve your problem for some other force that will make it follow that same path, and it'll look like a reasonable solution. And you can actually, picture just a toy model in your mind about, just a charged particle moving along, and it's, moving along through a gravitational field. So it's moving along a curved geodesic. But You could make it look locally flat and then explain the fact it's moving in a certain way by the force. But what we're going to get to is situations where you can't do that. And you can't, you know, where you really know it's curved and it's really coming from gravity. Okay. So that's it for today. If there's any questions? Okay. All right.